Coming up next on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville, it's Apropos of Something, co-hosted by Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence. Apropos of Something welcomes experts, activists, and the marginalized from our community to discuss how the latest policies are affecting everyday people. Apropos of Something is brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. And now, here's Ellen.
Welcome to Apropos of Something. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville Resistance Radio, and I like to say Persistence Radio. Apropos of Something airs live every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. I'm going to cheer author before we even get started. We have two esteemed and accomplished authors with us today. Charles Shields is an award-winning biographer who's published the first biographies of Kurt Vonnegut, Harper Lee, and John Williams. His Mockingbird, A Portrait of Harper Lee, is a New York Times bestseller and is in its 10th printing. We'll talk about his books, including his latest, The Man Who Wrote the Perfect Novel, John Williams and Stoner. And we're also speaking with Heath Lee. Her book tells the true story of a fierce band of women who battled Washington and Hanoi to bring their husbands home from the jungles of Vietnam. It's a page-turner and has been optioned by Reese Witherspoon for a major motion picture. The book is The League of Wives, the untold story of the women who took on the U.S. government to bring their husbands home from Vietnam. And my friend Nancy Lawrence, I'm glad you're home. Are you there?
You mean in the studio?
In the studio. Your home studio.
I'm definitely here. Ellen, I haven't said this in a while. I'm telling you, you have a career in dust jacket English literature. I'm sure you don't even, you're an honorary degree. You're getting the first one. That was, of course, neither of those two people, but having listened to that, I mean, that was awesome, is what I'm saying.
Well, these guys are the ones who made that possible, but thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah,
very much.
And you know, of all weekends to have two amazing writers, it's President's Day weekend, and we have one who reads not a word. And but truly, it is President's Day weekend. And I was thinking, all these President's Day sales going on, right? Let's shop for a new president. They're
good
on
idea.
Sale. Let's get a President's Day sale going. Let's find one and install this person in the White House while that guy's golfing.
As I always think about, can we pay him to leave? Can we just... It's been done.
I'm sure there's a price.
In other governments. And I wanted to point out that, speaking of authors, and you know what you just said... And writing, the longest sentence, this is kind of like an early palate cleanser, but an early little palate cleanser, the longest sentence ever printed is apparently 823 words in Victor Hugo's Les Miserables. And speaking of sentences, don't you think, I mean, that harkens...
Manafort
has the longest sentence, even a lot, like 80 times longer than the Watergate people, something like that.
And speaking of sentences of a man that apparently will be owing at least $52 million, I am putting that on my tax return. See Manafort. He's going to pay for my 50. It well covers whatever I owe, which will be too much.
Yeah.
But anyway, $52 million. Can we all just cite that guy at the bottom of our return?
I know. So, okay. And I think the government's making quite a lot of money on these guys, you know. To that point.
Right. Mueller's bringing in the witch hunt dollars. Yes.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Anyway, I think we should get right to our first guest, don't you?
Yeah.
So while I'm turning up the volume so we can hear him, you can find Apropos of Something, all 73 shows on Apple Podcasts.
Well, that's convenient.
It is. So our first guest, I'm so honored to have him here, Charles Shields. He's an award-winning biographer. He's published the first biographies of Kurt Vonnegut, Harper Lee, and John Williams. His Mockingbird, as I mentioned before, is a New York Times bestseller. It's in its 10th printing. His latest book is The Man Who Wrote the Perfect Novel, John Williams and Stoner. Publishers Weekly said it was a rich biography and that by the end of his finely crafted work, readers will feel they have some insight into this talented, troubled enigma of a man. We're going to find out what makes this guy an enigma. And also, I just wanted to mention his book, So It Goes, Kurt Vonnegut, A Life, was described described as incisive, gossipy page turner of a biography by Janet Maslin. It's won a bunch of awards. So without further ado, let's hear from the man himself. Welcome to the show, Charles.
Thank you, Ellen and Nancy, for having me.
Hey, yep.
Yeah, so I've heard you're a meticulous researcher, and you must be to do these kinds of books. So for Harper Lee's Mockingbird, how did you go about researching somebody who never really wanted to be interviewed and kept the world at a distance?
That was almost an oral history in that I had to talk to lots and lots of people because she left no papers. And real treasure trove was the papers of Truman Capote, her next-door neighbor, when she was growing up. And in Truman's papers, there were a number of things there by Harper Lee. But by and large, I had to find people who knew her throughout her life.
And, you know, regarding her, what did you find about her that you had no idea, you know, specifically, what were your feelings about the connection between her and Truman Capote when he was writing In Cold Blood? Did you find anything about possibly her contributing to that one?
Well, I discovered that if it were a just world, it would be In Cold Blood by Truman Capote with Harper Lee. But Truman Capote was jealous of Harper Lee's success and sidelined her. When he was asked directly on talk shows, did she contribute to the book, he said, well, she was there and she's a very warm person. But in fact, Truman could not have penetrated Kansas cattle farmers had not Harper Lee been along, because when Truman arrived out there, they didn't know what to make of him.
What did she do to help him?
Well, she is she can be very warm, and she immediately got in with sort of the church-going crowd and the people who would go to diners to talk and have coffee. That's her milieu. And Truman Capote, you know, although he spent some time in a small town, was mainly a New Yorker, a very small, effeminate man. And Harper Lee, they understood, but as she said, they regarded Truman as someone who had just arrived from the moon.
And what about, getting to her, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird, when the Ghost at a Watchman hubbub was all coming up, why was it written? Mm-hmm. What did it mean? How did that affect your original book? And I'll stop there. You know, one question at a time. How did that affect your book when you reprinted it, et cetera?
Well, I already knew about Ghost at a Watchman, and I mentioned it in the original biography before I revised it, the one that came out in 2006. I saw that in the records of her agent that a book called Ghost at a Watchman had been submitted and had made the rounds and wasn't successful, and that the title was changed from Ghost at a Watchman to Kill a Mockingbird. And that led me to believe that Ghost at a Watchman was an earlier draft of To Kill a Mockingbird, and not an entirely different book either, because after To Kill a Mockingbird came out, her agent and publicist tried to get her to write another book. They were looking for a second novel, a follow-up, and it never came. Well, if Ghost at a Watchman was considered a viable novel on its own, why didn't they just take it to press? So it was an early draft, and it shows all the hallmarks of someone who's finding her way as a novelist.
What did you think of it?
I didn't like it at all.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, although I thought it was very interesting to see an aspect of Atticus that we hadn't seen before. I mean, when last we left him, he was a man in his 50s in the South in the 1930s, and his attitudes were regarded as progressive and very liberal. But when we meet him again in the late 1950s, we see more of who he was, which is the son of a Confederate soldier, an arch segregationist, a white supremacist, someone who's fair-minded in terms of, you know, abiding by the law. But as he says to his daughter in Ghost at a Watchman, do you want them sitting next to you on a bus?
Mm-hmm.
So did your views of Harper Lee change at all after all your research and, you know, reading that book, like her views on civil rights?
Well, no. People confuse Harper Lee with civil rights activism of the 1960s, and really she had no interest in that. In fact, like most Southerners, she believed that federal troops did not belong in the South, that the South would solve problems in its own ways. She's really a very provincial woman. She said at one time, I just want to be the Jane Austen of a small segment of the South. And that was her lifestyle. She really was a product of her times and her environment. And what informed her compassion was sort of a Christian ethic about treating people fairly and empathizing with other people. But in terms of politics, she was very typical of her time and generation.
Do you think there was any biographical, do you think that Finch was based on people in her life, like her father.
Was her father to a T. Mm. Oh, right down to his mannerisms and his attitudes and his kindness. He was a good father, not particularly warm, but she loved him a great deal. Everybody in town knew that Mr. Lee was Atticus Finch. In fact, when they would stop him on the streets of Monroeville and ask him to sign her book, they would say, but sign it Atticus Finch.
Oh.
And what about, since, you know, all the focus on Ghost Sweater Watchmen, what about the fact that this book is now a play on Broadway? How do you think they did, you know, with that adaptation?
Well, kudos to Aaron Sorkin for doing what needed to be done, which was showing us the development, the narrative arc of Atticus Finch as a person. Do you know that Harper Lee's lawyer did not want any deviation from the original book, but you can't take someone who has talent the caliber of Aaron Sorkin's and expect him to just stage a novel. That's two different mediums, two different genres. So he did what he needed to do, which was he took two books and used it to create a more nuanced and deeper portrait of prejudice and politics and the South.
And speaking of, you know, people that, father figures like Atticus Finch, how about Mr. Vonnegut as a father, you know, as a father in his own life? You know, how did that affect his writing, his family dynamics?
Well, Kurt introduced something to me that I later developed in the John Williams book, which is the tension between the life you live and what you write about. Kurt Vonnegut was not the person that you would imagine behind the books. And consequently, when my biography came out, true Vonnegutians, as I call them, were very upset. They had imagined this curly-haired Kurt Vonnegut as sort of a mystical figure, very wise, very warm. And in fact, Kurt Vonnegut at base was an advertising man who finally hit a vein of gold with college students in the 1960s.
So you interviewed him. I mean,
I knew him.
You knew him. So
I was probably one of the last people to see him alive.
Wow, that's amazing. So was it hard to get him to allow you to write this book?
Well, the first time I wrote him, he sent back a drawing of himself that he had done on an 8x11x17 piece of paper. And underneath his portrait, it said, "This is a portrait of me demurring on the offer of the fine biographer Charles J. Shields to be my biographer." And I put that up on the mantle above the fireplace, and I looked at it for a little while. And my wife pointed out that demurring is not a strong word. So I wrote back to him, and I said, "You know, give me a second chance here. Here's who I am." And I told him more about myself and our commonalities. And about a week later, I received a postcard with a little drawing of it of himself smoking. And above that, it said, "Okay."
That's it?
Yeah.
That's amazing. Was he a good, was he a good sketch artist?
Yeah, he was good. He was a doodler had a cartoony aspect to his drawing that was charming.
Mm-hmm. How much time did you get to how much time did you get to spend with him? How much access did he give you?
Oh, he was glad to see me. Kurt Vonnegut was a very lonely man. He would call me late at night, apropos of nothing, and usually three sheets to the wind, and want to talk about his past and about his childhood.
Wow.
And I was raised outside Chicago, and he was raised outside Indianapolis, so there was an overlap there in terms of, you know, Midwestern sensibilities and things. And I knew many of the places he was talking about. But it would take me off guard to pick up the phone at 9 o'clock at night and hear this gravelly voice say, "This is Kurt Vonnegut. How's my biography coming?"
Wow. So if he was three sheets to the wind, did he ever say things that, you know, you had to ask, "Is this okay to write about?"
No, he was... Vonnegut spent a lot of his time hitting the paint, as my father used to say. And so it was hard to separate Kurt sober from Kurt in his cups.
Is that an expression? I've never heard that. In his cups.
Yes, it is. I think it's Shakespearean.
Okay.
Well, of course why I didn't hear about it. I'm sorry. His early life. What do you think of his early life affecting how he wrote, And his approach, to his own career.
Well, Kurt was the product of an upper middle class family in Indianapolis that valued education and also, as he said, was trying to be part of sort of a German-American aristocracy in Indianapolis. Indianapolis was dominated in commerce and politics by German-Americans who had come to that area before the 1900s. And Kurt was the legacy of those people. So he had a vision of himself becoming one of them. But World War II shocked him out of that vision of himself, and he emerged a young man who was severely traumatized. And I would say that by and large, Kurt was a disenchanted person who found a sort of a rueful humor in the way that we would like things to be and the way they actually are.
So the book title is So It Goes, Kurt Vonnegut, A Life. What does the title mean?
That was a phrase that Kurt would use periodically in Slaughterhouse-Five. He would describe some horrific event and then undercut it by saying, so it goes.
Mm. And that experience, what can you tell us about that? About his experiences during the war, fighting and being a prisoner of war, actually, mostly?
Kurt was at the Battle of the Bulge. His regiment was completely surrounded by the Germans. They were taken as a bunch, and he became part of the 25,000 American prisoners of war. It was the largest defeat of arms in American history. He was put on a boxcar, taken to a Stalag, where he remained for a little while, and then was chosen to go to Dresden to be part of a work crew that would just serve as sort of laborers, day laborers. But as Dresden came under pressure from the Russians coming from the east and the Allies coming from the west, supplies ran short. Kurt began to starve. Then Dresden was bombed from the air, and Kurt was on a detail to retrieve bodies from basements. And if you can imagine a young man, a sensitive young man in his about 20 years old, going into a darkened basement and retrieving floating bodies, that was his experience.
Wow. And this, in your view, is this the book, Slaughterhouse-Five, that, you know, was the, ironically, or whatever, the thing that made him a successful writer? Is this the one that got him on the map, in your view?
It was a combination of commerce and creativity. Slaughterhouse-Five was indeed his best book, and as he said to someone, I felt that I had reached some kind of end to my career, that's really what I'd been meaning to say for 20 years, that I had crossed over the peak of a roof, so to speak. And the commerce part of it was that an entrepreneur named Sam Lawrence in the publishing industry gathered together all of Vonnegut's previous books, about five or six titles, and brought them out as a set with a uniform look to them. And so although Kurt had been, writing, had been being published now and then and going out of print like, so many candles, when he finally got these books brought together, it created a body of work, and we understood his oeuvre, so to speak.
So we're speaking with Charles Shields. He's a best-selling biographer of mid-century American authors. We're talking about his books written about Kurt Vonnegut, Harper Lee, and John Williams. We'll be right back with much more from Charles Shields, and also coming up soon is Heath Lee. We'll talk with her. Stick with us. Good morning, everyone. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're speaking with author Charles Shields, and in a few moments, we're going to speak to the wonderful Heath Lee. So, Charles, let's turn to your latest book, The Man Who Wrote the Perfect Novel, John Williams and Stoner. Tell us who John Williams was.
John Williams was a professor of English at the University of Denver in the mid-1950s until the early 1980s, and his book Stoner is a cult phenomenon now. When it came out in 1965 or so, it only sold 2,500 copies and disappeared. But then it came out in Europe in about 2011 and became enormously popular, and Europeans referred to it as Stoner Mania. My biography had a sort of a similar trajectory in that my agent and I couldn't find an author in the United States to carry the biography or publish the biography of John Williams. So first it came out in Europe, and it's come out in Italian, Spanish, Scandinavian,
Dutch.
And now it's just come out from the University of Texas Press. And what I try to do is once again talk about that creative tension between the life of the author and the works that he or she created. And John Williams was sort of what we used to call in the middle of the 20th century a man's man, in that he was he played around, he drank, he was tough, and yet Stoner shows insights into human nature that are remarkable. It's a quiet but profound book. It reminds me of The Good Soldier by Ford Madox Ford. It's brilliant in its understatement, and when you put the book down, you sigh and think, you know, who was this? Who is John Williams? And that was my reaction, and that's why I investigated his life.
Mm-hmm. And what things did you find out about him in your research, since I know you love the research part as much?
Well, right? John was willing to face the facts about what he wanted in life. He knew he couldn't be all things to all people, and so he was a professor who cut corners to devote more time to his art. And he recognized that he was making a trade that way. His first calling was to be a writer and a novelist, and that was his bid for immortality. And so consequently, as an instructor, he was good, not particularly inspired. And as I say, he cut corners in terms of borrowing other people's research. One famous critic, Ivor Winters, called him on it. But Williams was adamant. His way of trying to make an imprint in life was writing fiction, and he was going to do anything to accomplish that.
So you mentioned there were remarkable insights in the book. Can you tell us some of what you mean?
Well, Stoner addresses something that I think is at the heart of the human journey, which is a search for identity. And John himself was searching for his own identity. See, John believed until he was 9 years old that he was John Williams, but his real name was John Jewell. His mother didn't tell him that his father had been murdered when John was an infant, and his stepfather was not his real father, and his sister was his half-sister. So John, at 9 years old, realized that the world is largely fiction. It's what people say it is. And that informed his sensibility as an author, but it also gave him a key to something that we're all, as I say, attempting to do, which is to find out what is the truth about us. Mm. And at the end of Stoner, when Professor Stoner is dying and has sacrificed some things in his life, like love and fatherhood, but has stood firm on others, like professionalism, as he's looking out the window and dying, he says to himself, well, at least I know who I am.
Do you think that everyone in their lives has to sacrifice something?
Yes, I think it's I think that it's almost a childlike idea that we can do everything equally well, and that we should try to do everything, that we our lives should be something like multitasking, mm-hmm. where we are parents and corporate types and churchgoers or temple-goers, and there is not enough time in life to do everything, and we have to look in the mirror and say, what's my obituary going to look like, and what do I want in it?
Do you think, I mean, since you used that in the title of your new book, did he, in your view, write the perfect novel?
Well, Morris Dickstein used that phrase in a review of Stoner in the New York Times Review of Books, and it's kind of a trick, and I don't mean to deceive the reader. It's the perfect novel in terms of what John Williams believed should be the perfect novel, and it went against the grain of novels in the 1960s. You know, in an era of postmodernism, John Williams wrote a very traditional book that showed time proceeding in a linear fashion and people growing old, what they learned and what they failed to learn, and he believed that was what a novel should do. It, you know, the great iron clock of the universe runs in one direction, and we should show people learning as they grow older. And that's what Stoner does. He goes from being a young farmer who goes to the University of Missouri, changes his major, and then dies much later, an English professor who's loved and lost.
So what have the reviews been like? I know there was a little bit of something to say about that.
I was upset by a review by Kirkus. I was really shocked by how dismissive it was. The reviewer said that the biography was yet another book about a white male alcoholic author, And I'm beginning to notice this trend in book reviewing. There's a judgment being made about whether a subject is worthy of being talked about because they either do or they don't conform to the notion of what is the good life, who should be being talked about. And I want to make this very clear. There are people on the left who are as authoritarian as any torch-bearing white supremacist in that they have a sense of what's permissible and what isn't. It's really disheartening to see art judged according to whether it means it contributes anything. I had an editor of an online magazine approach me recently who wanted to know how Stoner had changed law and society. Mm-hmm. And I wrote back to him and I said, it didn't. It was a work of art. And it didn't change it any more than a painting by Picasso or a symphony by Beethoven. And that was not John Williams' intention. So if we're going to judge art according to whether it belongs with other, you know, with people at the barricades fighting for social justice, we're going to slide into a serious anti-intellectualism in this country.
Well, I'm curious now that, well, this is a recent development in your in reviews of your books, but when you choose writers to write about, what is your criteria for choosing them?
Well, it's a very personal criteria. First of all, I like to be first on the scene. I like to be the first person to do it with no other books about the person so that I start from primary sources and with people who knew the person I'm writing about. That's just my thing, is to be there alone and to find my way. And then also it has to be so interesting to me that I can work on it for years. There are some projects I've started where I lose interest, but I have to have a commonality with the person, something that really appeals to me that will keep me in my room at the computer as the seasons change, writing.
And what about, because you are volunteering to write about writers, is there an extra degree of difficulty writing about a writer versus an event or something else?
Well, I think it was Leon Edel who wrote the definitive biography of Henry James, who said that if you have someone's works in hand, you have the key to who they are. And I reverse engineer a life from looking at the works and trying to see between the lines what the subtext is and finding evidence of things in a life that led to that work of art.
So in these books that you've written about Kurt Vonnegut, Harper Lee, John Williams, yeah. Who have you learned the most from?
Right now, the person I'm learning the most about is Lorraine Hansberry. I'm writing a biography of Lorraine Hansberry, the author, the playwright of A Raisin in the Sun. And I'm learning a great deal about her and black communists, life in Harlem, socialism, the Broadway world, playwriting. It's really something I've never entered into before. And it was kind of an internal resistance for the first year that I was working on the book. I felt like I don't know anything about this. You know, this is so different for me. But I have, by dint of reading and thinking, I think I've managed to think my way into her life.
Has she been on your radar? I don't know how you decide what to write about or what to postpone, etc. But had she been on your radar for a while? How did she come into your life as a subject to write about?
Well, we were raised not too far apart. I was raised in southern Chicagoland, and she was raised in the Black Belt, the Bronzeville neighborhood of Chicago. And I know that neighborhood as well as any white outsider could. But we were both Chicagoans. She went to the University of Wisconsin. I went to the University of Illinois. Like with Vonnegut, there are enough intersections in our lives that I felt that I could go forward.
Well, thank you so much for being here, Charles Shields. We look forward to that book. When is that coming out?
The next year.
Next year, that's There's Always Something Left to Love, Lorraine Hansberry, and A Raisin in the Sun. And, of course, the latest book, The Man Who Wrote the Perfect Novel. Thanks for writing all of these books,
these wonderful books.
Yeah, thanks for being here. Yes.
Yeah.
Were you going to say something, Nance?
Oh, I was going to say something about him being the perfect interview, but where does that leave Heath? So I'm not going to say that.
Right. These are a pair of perfect...
This is not a pipe. I'm not saying it. I'm saying that I'm not saying it.
Okay. I love when your personality comes out during these interviews. Yeah. We've got to make that happen more. So speaking of, do you have a news of note for us?
Oh, sorry to be psychic. I do.
Yeah. Go on.
You have a news of note. I have something about walls that actually are a national emergency. President Slumlord aims to imprison detained immigrant children on, get this, a former landfill, and also it's a Superfund site. It has the distinction of being both things. This is the Air Force Base, Goodfellas Air Force Base in Texas. It's a hazard. Was a hazardous waste site. They're planning on putting 7,500 unaccompanied children there, who are, of course, especially vulnerable to environmental contaminants. Like, there's multiple toxic chemicals, there's heavy metals, there's contaminated groundwater, it's steeped in lead, arsenic, this thing called a PFAS, which is a pollutant that affects the neurodevelopment of people, children especially, and ups their chances of getting autism. And after, you know, this, it's not enough they're being separated from their parents at the border. You know, that's not enough cruelty. And the appeal to them of an Air Force base, it's federal land. They can do what they want on federal land. They're the federal government, and they can, you know, manage, avoid state regulations of any kind to protect child welfare. That
horrible.
Is what I have as a news.
Well, I'm going to do a wall of Debbie Upper, you know, with that, so that. This is my news of note. Ruth Bader Ginsburg returns to the court for the first time since she had cancer surgery in December. So we are all extremely happy about that. I feel
speaking of tax returns, I'm putting in my dollar for more bubble wrap for all of her bones. She has to stay intact.
Bubble wrap.
I know she's a dynamo, but I'm...
I feel like
calcium.
She's.
Calcium.
I feel like she's doing it for us. You know, like, I mean, she would do it anyway because it's who she is.
Yeah.
But I'm projecting, like, she's just hanging in there to save our democracy.
You. With you, Ellen. Yeah.
Anyhow.
Totally,
so, with no further ado, I wanted to introduce our next guest, Heath Lee. She is the author of this very long title. I have to say, The League of.
I didn't come up with that subtitle.
We don't have time to interview you, Heath. We just have to say your title and thank you for appearing on the show.
That's just it. Say the first part.
Okay. The League of Wives, and then we'll talk
Perfect.
About what that means. But anyone moved by Hidden Figures is going to love Heath's new book. It's an accounting of the fierce band of women who battled Washington and Hanoi to bring their husbands home from that war as POWs and MIAs. It chronicles this little-known story of these women for the first time. The husbands were brutally tortured, starved, they were in rat-infested and worse, Vietnamese prisons for years. And these women were the ones who got them home. Heath's background is in museum education. She's curated history exhibits in museums across the country. And the book is also a museum exhibit opening at the Richmond Museum of History and Culture on March 2nd. She is a Robert J. Dole Curatorial Fellow. Welcome to the show, Heath.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, so your book is a page-turner. I can attest to that because I am reading it. I'm thoroughly enjoying it. Thank you for sending that advance copy. The book will come out in April.
Yes, April 2nd.
Okay,
yes.
So everybody look for that. So can you first set the stage of what it was like then for women, particularly as officers' wives in the 60s? I know they overcame incredible odds to do what they did. And the book title says they fought the U.S. government. Mm-hmm. They also fought the culture. So set that stage for us.
Well, sure. Well, the visual image, being a curator as well as a writer, I always kind of start with the protocol guides the military put out in the 50s and 60s, the Navy wife, the Marine wife, the Army wife, the Air Force wife. These are our protocol guides written by former military wives and supported by the military that have lots of great advice about practical advice about deployments, about different bases, things like that. But they also have these social prescriptions from the 1960s, particularly about women's roles, families' roles, and how everybody needs to play by the rules. So that's kind of the stage which these wives are operating from. When I start the story, it's in 1964, 1965. This is when the air war in Vietnam really gets going under LBJ. Pilots are being shot out of the sky, and the wives are looking at these protocol guides, going to the index and finding there is nothing about prisoners of war or what to do. There are lots of social prescriptions about how to write thank you notes, but there isn't a lot about what to do when your husband's in the Hanoi Hilton. So eventually these books end up, you know, on a bonfire, practically burned, because they can't use them anymore, and they have to create their own guidebooks and rule guides. And that's what these ladies proceed to do with no path, no radar. They just have to figure it out, and they do it beautifully.
How did they find, I know there's many of them, but whoever started this got this in motion. How did these women find each other?
Yes, well, really, the person who ignites this whole movement, this POW-MIA concern movement, is a woman named Sybil Stockdale. And you might remember, have heard of Jim Stockdale, who ran actually with Ross Perot in a famous bid for president and vice president back in the 90s. But before that, he was a very famous prisoner of war. He was one of the top-ranking naval POWs, a big resistor, a huge leader of the movement. And Sybil, as military wives tend to do, reflected that role among the wives. When Jim was shot down, she kept quiet for a number of years, like the LBJ government had instructed the wives to do, and decided after 3 years that this would not do. This was not going to work. And even before that, she had started reaching out to wives in the San Diego area where she was based, and organizing them into the San Diego League of Wives for Prisoners of War, which also included the missing wives. And she starts the movement on the West Coast, and it spreads out from there all over the country to the East Coast. There's a big group of Virginia Beach wives led by Jane Denton and Louise Mulligan. There are people in the interior West, and it's just like a wildfire when the women finally go public with some of the concerns they have about their husbands, mainly that they're being tortured and our government is lying to everyone about it. Mm-hmm. So that's a big concern.
Yeah. So we're speaking with Heath Lee about her book, The League of Wives. We're going to be right back after this short break. Stick with us. Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Apropos of Something. We air every Saturday morning at 10 a.m. We have the pleasure of speaking with author Heath Lee right now. So, Heath, in your book, The League of Wives, you talk about the keep quiet policy. Tell us about what that is.
Sure. Well, the keep quiet policy was kind of a long-term policy the military had had even before under Kennedy and other presidents. And then in my book, we're starting really with the Johnson administration. And the military and the government had a policy, if people were taken as prisoners of war, that their wives and families had to keep quiet. They could not talk about this to anyone outside their immediate family. They could not, in the Vietnam War particularly, they weren't allowed to tell anyone what had happened to their husbands. And you can imagine how difficult this would have been to go to church with your makeup on and your bouffant hairdo set perfectly, and you know your children are in school, and where is their father? What is going on? And all the wives I interviewed, and there were, you know, dozens of them, said that they were said, it almost like the guys when they're captured, name, rank, and serial number, nothing else. And they didn't even tell people that much. It was, where's your husband? Oh, well, he's deployed. Well, he was in prison, you know, shot down. And many of them, they were missing in action. They didn't even know where they were. So this keep quiet policy obviously just can't last. It's impossible. And really, when the groups of women start organizing themselves among themselves, they were talking fairly early about what had happened. But they did not go public until under Sybil Stockdale in 1968, she has had enough of this, and she goes to the San Diego Union and breaks the silence about not only her husband, but the government's other policy, and this was Johnson, was not to tell people that prisoners of war were being tortured, because it would be bad for morale and, of course, undermine his coming election. So it had a lot to do with keeping the faith of the American people intact.
How did they find out they were being tortured?
Oh, this I found so fascinating. It was a very James Bond type situation. These wives, a number of them, Sybil Stockdale being one, Jane Denton being another, many of them were recruited by naval intelligence. And I really focused mostly on this part with the naval wives. I'm sure it was going on in other branches, but they were recruited to code letters, secret letters to their husbands. So they would work on these letters. There's a lot of double talk in them, symbols and signs that they would work with the wives to figure out what the husbands would go, gosh, that doesn't make sense. This is odd. And then they would soak the letters in water or in many cases in urine. That would be all they had. And secret messages would come up. It was just incredible. So these letters went back and forth eventually, and they decoded them at Naval Intelligence, and they would find out that Jim Stockdale's letter, for instance, came back and he said, in leg iron, 16 hours a day, beaten, tortured, no medical care. So they knew that that was happening largely through the efforts of the wives, and also a very famous film with Jeremiah Denton, who's a very famous POW, where he blinked torture in Morse code. Naval Intelligence caught it immediately. The wives didn't know for years, many of them, but they knew immediately. And I interviewed some of the guys who saw this film first, and one of them said, we saw that and we just cried. We knew immediately what was happening. But the government said, keep quiet. Even within the government, they couldn't talk about it.
Chills.
Yeah. Go ahead, Ellen.
It's pretty horrible.
No, you go ahead, Nancy.
That idea, because I know they are military wives. These are not at least initially, activists. These aren't.
No.
The whole thing is to be the dutiful mm-hmm. military wife to follow his policy. So, for each of them, how much of a struggle was that to like open their eyes and not. And throw out that protocol manual or, you know, activate themselves?
Oh, that's a great question. And it varied between, you know, personality-wise. And the ones that I kind of set up in the book in that particular instance, Sybil Stockdale and Louise Mulligan are both New Englanders. They're very forceful. They have a very low tolerance for this government doublespeak and cover-up. And they, earlier on, are able to throw out these military protocols and speak out. Jane Denton is Southern, is very traditional. You know, her husband was super traditional. And I think she worried a lot about what would he think and what would the people in the military think, and really thought about whether it was a good idea to come out and speak out against the government. I mean, I think very legitimately, many of them worried about if the husbands did make it back, it could ruin their career if the wives were outspoken activists or criticizing. So it was a huge internal struggle. And even for the more outspoken women, they went for years before they were willing to throw the protocol manuals out and go public. So it was it was against everything they had been taught as military wives to speak out. But they realized finally that they were way smarter, way better informed, and just better diplomats than our government was. So they eventually go for it.
So when you talk about, you know, the culture that we discussed before, I love the way you write about it. It was a Byzantine world of calling cards, shrimp forks, and proper thank you notes. So imagine them speaking out or something like this when the government is telling them that they can't do it. Did they actually form an organization?
Yes, they do form an organization first in 67 in San Diego called the San Diego League of Wives under Sybil Stockdale. But that explodes in 68 when she goes public. Then everyone is like breathing the sigh of relief across the country. And then eventually by 1970, they form something called the National League of Families for Prisoners of War and Missing in Southeast Asia. And that's the group that still exists today to identify remains, to help with POW efforts. It's a very different organization now than it was. But under Sybil, this is the platform, organizing as a group versus the individual voices are not heard. No one takes them seriously. But it's such a cause for organizing, which I think we're seeing today with so many movements like Me Too or Time's Up. Similar concept that to be taken seriously, particularly in that time period, you needed a legitimate organization with stationery, a bank account. I mean, that's really all it took. And Sybil laughs about it, saying, you know, we didn't know the first thing about organizing. I was like a fairy godmother. I just waved my wand and made it so. And we didn't really think too much about it. But Bob Burrows, who was the naval intelligence contact, kept saying, organize, organize. He was a huge supporter, and that is what turns the tide in terms of presidential administrations finally listening. LBJ also goes. The Vietnam War puts him out, so he does not run again. Nixon takes over, and Nixon in this case, which was so interesting, he is the one that understands these women are important and they need government support. And it's like night and day between the two administrations. So very interesting.
Yeah. So Nixon actually helped.
Were there people in the State Department? Were there, like, people trying to help and knowing they, too, weren't supposed to be doing so because of the government's overall shut it up policy?
Well, the State Department was actually not very helpful. Averill Harriman was the one running this department, and he was known as the crocodile. You know, he's very snappy, very old school. He did not support the wives at all, and really the entire State Department was like just a big wall. You know, there was no help from the State Department. So the help they got, really, Bob Burrows in Naval Intelligence among these wives, he was it. So, and he was going up, above, under, around the State Department to get things done. So I would say no, there were very few helpful people in the State Department. And as one of the ladies, Janie Sheedy, said, they would just see us coming and go, oh no, here they come. And they would, the State Department would practically bar the door. So they all had to use various means around this, including working with the peace activists and the anti-war activists, who were the last people on earth these conservatives, conservative military wives wanted to work with, but they formed a very uneasy alliance with them to get things through to the prison camps.
And you mentioned Louise Mulligan as well. And what was it about her May Day speech, in your view, that was so galvanizing or such a milestone?
Oh, yes. Oh, I love that May Day speech that Louise makes. It's just, you can see it sort of in your mind's eye. I compare her to, she's sort of like the Joan of Arc of the POW MIA movement. She's very, again, New Englander, very forceful, not afraid to speak out. So she gets up at this 1970 May Day sort of conference, which is like, I call it the National League's coming out party. It's sort of the first time they're all together. Bob Dole has put these women in Constitution Hall in D.C. And Louise gets up on the stage and everybody's making, you know, these speeches about how awful the prisoner of war situation is and the missing. And she gets up and she just screams, May Day, May Day, and like screams it, which is so awesome. And so, of course, May Day comes from the French May Day, which is help me. You know, it's the pilot's call of distress. But it's this visceral sort of pronouncement that everybody in the audience, which they're all, by the way, the National League is composed only of family members. You have to be related to the prisoner or missing to be included. So they all are like, oh my gosh, here's somebody voicing exactly what we feel, like a visceral response, and getting it out there. And it just galvanizes everybody. It bonds them together, and they respond, I think, just on a very base level to what she's saying. She's kind of breaking that silence in a very, very loud, verbal, in-your-face kind of way.
Well, as I'm sure our listeners can tell, the book is really fascinating and interesting. And Reese Witherspoon thought so as well. Her production company has optioned the movie before the book even came out. So
yes, I was so thrilled. I mean, so thrilled. She was the number one person I would have wanted to do that. And I did have an excellent book to film agent who was able to get it in front of Reese and her people, and also the people at Fox who did Hidden Figures. So it was kind of, I think, a natural fit. I was writing this book, you know, even before Hidden Figures came out. So I didn't really have that in mind while I was writing most of it, but it fits a kind of a similar template, I think, without me intentionally doing that. But they've been great to work with. And, you know, if the film's been optioned and I'll be a producer on the film and hopefully get the historical elements all straight, you know, being around. But I'm thrilled. I mean, it just gives it, like, the exhibit I'm doing and the movie. I just think right now it's so important, particularly with the younger people, to have multiple platforms where you can reach someone. So this has three places you can access it and get it in a way that it's going to make sense to you.
And yeah, back to the exhibit, because that too is real and ongoing. Mm-hmm. Was it always your view of this, if you had one, to have these things happening concurrently, the book and the exhibit?
Well, you know, it's funny. I had seen one other biographer that I really like, Natalie Dykstra, who wrote a book about Clover Adams, who is a photographer in the 19th century. Maybe three or four years ago, she had an exhibit concurrent with her book about Clover, with Clover's photographs. And I thought, gosh, that's really cool. And, you know, I've done so much curatorial work. I think I want to do something like that. So I did see one other precedent. That's the only other precedent I've seen. I'm sure there have been others, but being a museum person and in that world, I thought, gosh, that would be really cool and really different. Publishers don't love it when you do things before the book comes out, but I think everybody came around to seeing that this was such a visual story that it really needed an exhibit for further explanation. And the ladies were all giving me all their stuff from that era that, like, their kids didn't necessarily want, their clothes, their gloves and hats, the protocol manuals. That's how I came across that. And it added so much to have these things all kind of fermenting at the same time. I mean, of course, I almost lost my mind trying to do it all at once. But in the end, it was such a neat creative process to do an exhibit at the same time as the book, or to do them sort of concurrently. It was really quite interesting to do it that way. And I would not take it back.
Yeah. I mean, it's so great when you read a great book and then to be able to go to something like that exhibit. Again, that's going to be starting, I think, March 2nd.
Yes, March 2nd. It'll be open to the public in Richmond at the Virginia Museum of History and Culture till September. And then it'll go to Coronado Historical Association and then to the Nixon Presidential Library. And then on from there, it'll be going for several more years, I think.
Fantastic. So what, before we run out of time, what projects are you working on now?
Well, I have one I'm investigating, so I am not ready to say a whole lot, except I think it will be a Virginia subject. I think it'll be, I've always wanted to do a project in the 20s. I mean, who doesn't love flappers? I mean, the clothes alone are just so fabulous. So I've always wanted to do that. Of course, women's suffrage, I'm fascinated by the temperance movement. So I think it'll be something, again, it's with me, it's always women. That's my interest. So it'll be something about women in the 20s, maybe in Virginia, maybe national. But I'm kind of in investigatory phase right now.
And this one you'll be turning into a musical or have an original score?
I'm sure I'll be
going for the Grammys this time.
Totally.
Is that the new barrier?
I think so. I think I'll star in it. I think it'll be a one-woman show. And embarrassing my teenage kids beyond belief, which will be worth every minute of it.
Yeah.
You know, you do it.
It's so easy to do that one.
It is.
Oh,
wait,
that's just easy.
It's easy. But you know you're on the right track when that's happening, I think.
Right.
Well, you're a champion of women. I love it. I love what you've written about.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for being here, for coming all the way from Roanoke.
Oh, thank you.
Heath Lee, her book is The League of Wives, The Untold Story of the Women Who Took on the U.S. Government to Bring Their Husbands Home from Vietnam.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, fantastic. Yeah. So, Nance, I wanted to mention that next week we have Kathy Barrow, an author of the cookbook Pie Squared. We're going to hear all about slab pies. Very different topic than today. And Dave Shilpa is back for her annual primer on the Oscar-nominated films, which will be the day after. She's a professor of media studies and expert on popular culture. She is really fun and knows her movies, that's for sure.
That is for sure. And maybe she'll know who's going to host the Oscars. Maybe we'll get the inside. No one is, apparently.
Oh, really?
Anyway, not yet, not officially. Anyway, so I don't know, Ellen. We don't really have. I'm looking at my.
We have exactly
clock, same
six.
Clock as you have. Do we have
60 seconds? So Can you make it?
Okay, then I'm just going to say this. I have a short one, a sentence. It took almost 44 years, but Don Cheadle is going to host Saturday Night Live tonight.
So. Oh, he's never hosted?
So there you go. He hasn't hosted before. It's a tragedy now being rectified.
Oh, thank you, Nancy. Yeah. Thanks, everyone, for being here. Charles Shields, great author, and Heath Lee. Remember, no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. Our music is by Springtide. Thank you so much, Nance. Couldn't do it without you.
Agreed.
Thanks for listening to Apropos of Something this morning on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Show and host Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence each Saturday at 10 for Apropos of Something. Brought to you by the Beckham team and Keller Williams. Show archive can be found at SeavillePodcast.com.